And welcome to Weather and Ag and Focus, 108 in the afternoon on this finally Friday, March 7th. Temperatures outside generally in the 30s. There's a few low 40s to the southwest of the FM area, and I think we'll top out most areas in the 30s today. Again, there will be a few low 40s. Not a bad start or not a bad end to the week, but even nicer weather on tap for the weekend. We'll have more on that in a bit, but I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with our Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. And finally, Friday, Bridget, how's your day going so far?
Well, I would say that finally Friday, yes, but personally, I was traveling, so honestly, as far as I'm concerned, it's still Tuesday, but it'll be fine. Okay. Everybody will get through this week. We'll all be good.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No doubt. And we've got some, we've really got some nice weather coming for this weekend. I think this is false spring number two for much of the area, as we've got temperatures normally this time of the year should be in the low 30s, but we're looking at temperatures this weekend well above that. For the rest of today, though, we're looking at highs close to 40 again, with winds out of the northwest about 5 to 10, partly cloudy, 25 tonight. And Saturday, a little breeze out of the northwest, about 10 to 20. And we're looking at temperatures in the upper 40s on Saturday, upper 50s on Sunday, and mostly sunny skies, and then temperatures near 60 on Monday. Can you believe that? That would break a record. The record on Monday right now currently stands at 58, and we set that last year. So hopefully Monday comes around, we can break that record. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people out on the trails over the weekend. It's going to be a really nice, and I'll tell you what, get outdoor chores. Maybe you want to clean up the yard a little bit, or just do any outdoor activities, do them this weekend, because we're getting very strong indications of a major storm system coming into our area as we head into next weekend. It looks like next Saturday and Saturday night look to be quite messy. And again, it's over a week away. The track of the storm will change a bit, but the LRC predicted this months ago, that right around mid-March, and then a couple more after that, we were going to start turning stormy, and sure enough, we're looking at a potential of a major snow event in parts of North and South Dakota. I think Minnesota's going to be mainly on the rain side for the majority of it. Now, where we stand in the FM area, that's where it's going to be crucial of the track of this storm. But if you have any travel plans across either North or South Dakota next weekend, keep up to date on the forecast. You very well may have to alter your travel plans. And please tell me you're not traveling anywhere next weekend, Bridget. Her mic is off, I think.
Oh,
there we go.
I'm going to be traveling in the same areas that you are, so that way anywhere I go, you get the storm, Dean. How's that?
Thanks a lot.
Sure, anytime. Glad to help.
Oh, man. But no, it's...
All right, so...
Go
ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just saying there. We're getting indications that parts of the state could have close to blizzard conditions out of this, so something definitely to keep an eye on. And like I said, normally we don't sound the alarm bells a week away, but the LRC, all of our medium range models are picking up on this storm now, so definitely something to watch.
Well, and this is what winter weather in North Dakota. We aren't at spring by any means as of yet, so. There are not just stormy conditions happening in the weather, in agriculture as well. CNH, which is the Case IH plant here in Fargo, has announced that about a third of their workers are going to be laid off. That's about 200 hourly employees. I don't like seeing that. I remember when this happened back late 80s, early 90s, we saw a lot of layoffs in the farm equipment segment. And right now, with incredible downturn on new tractor purchases, and even the used market has really softened up. These are some of the things that we're going to see. When you have commodity prices that are low, corn, soybeans, wheat, et cetera, I mean, really the exception here is if you can nail a good contract every so often, you're going to see a lot less purchasing by farmers and ranchers. And when that's happening, you don't have the usual turnover in the industry. So right now, if we have low commodity prices, folks aren't buying. Now, with some of the uncertainty of tariffs, et cetera, many folks don't want to stick their necks out and make new purchases and then potentially have problems down the road with financing, with carrying that large purchase on a loan, et cetera. So right now, we are looking at a number of these things happening. We know that year on year, from last year to this year, most major tractor manufacturers, and when I say tractor, I'm also including tillage combines, et cetera, are down about 25 to 30% year on year new product sales. And that's the second year in a row that they are down. So we're going to watch to see how things develop, but it's an unfortunate blow to this area when you have those layoffs happening. So again, that's going to be the case. IH plant here in Fargo, they will be losing some employees, I'm afraid.
Now, with the commodity prices being down, does that have anything to do with the drought in South America?
We've had commodity prices depressed for the last several years. We are currently oversupplying the market, and when you're being beat globally because you are being outproduced on a cheaper price basis by various other countries, so they're making some pretty big deals, Brazil to China, et cetera, that's going to matter. We just have seen low crop prices for a consistent amount of time. There was a spike during the pandemic. Things have tapered off now. And realistically, farmers are all very busy looking for where can they get their most diversity? What can they do differently in their farming practices to find better markets? Some folks have done that with, you know, very specific niche crops, and that happens all over the country. Here, a lot of times we've been able to fill that gap with something like a barley crop. But we've talked about beer being down because less people are drinking beer. There's a lot more consumption of seltzers and brown liquors. So we aren't going to have the barley acres like we normally would. NDSU has recently brought out their crop projections sheets so that you can sit down with a budget and expense out what is it going to take for the inputs. Then you can estimate your crop for harvest and what is your break-even cost going to be, et cetera. And right now, not all of them look great. So hopefully for those who've managed to find great contracts in dry edible beans, sunflowers, that will help if you've been doing some forward contracting on your corn. That's going to make a difference as well. But if you're just waiting for the open cash market, that's likely going to be a bit risky right now. I read some articles this morning where central North Dakota, there are pockets of dry, but not everyone is completely considering it a drought situation. And they're concerned that it's a possibility of, for them, planting all soybeans, not corn, because they see that as more viable, especially because they might not have as much on-farm storage to deal with as well. And corn, of course, when you have big bushels of corn, it's a bigger crop size, the size of the kernel, so you need more storage capacity. So we're gonna see how things go for folks this spring, but 2025 is going to be a challenge for a lot of farmers.
That's not what that and the farm bill, boy, we just, not good news.
Well, one thing that people are definitely doing, as I mentioned earlier, is diversifying. And that's what our guest today is going to be talking about. We're going to be joined by Orion Romine. He is in Texas. The reason I ran across Orion, I see him on Twitter and I follow a lot of what he does. Not only does he farm, but he has gotten sick of the wild hogs causing damage on his farm. So that's decimating crops, causing other issues as well. And he just decided to find a way to eliminate more of them. So he's going to have an interesting side business to talk about with us. But I have a lot of questions for him in regards to what's happening with those hogs, what kind of damage they can do, et cetera. And I think we'll be surprising. We get frustrated when Canadian geese land and eat new corn plants because they're really fresh and tender. But I don't think that's near what Orion and his family have to go through down in Texas. So we're going to talk with him when we return. Let's do a check of the markets with American Ag Network, and we'll be right back. Welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus, and very excited to talk with our guest from South Texas today. That's Orion Romine. And Orion, what are things like weather-wise in Texas on a day like today?
Very windy, very hot, pretty dry. The sound engineer, I heard y'all's weather forecast, and it's currently 85 here at the moment.
Is it early for things to be quite this warm for you? I mean, it's just March 10th.
No, ma'am. We will have some cold spells. You know, northerners will come in up through about Easter where we'll, you know, like we'll still have a few mornings in the 30s, but they won't stay there very long. But our average temperature will be 70 to 80 degrees here from here on out.
Okay. Well, where exactly in Texas are you, Orion? I said South Texas, but that doesn't give near enough of an idea where you might be located.
We're actually out west. The closest large town or something somebody could find on the map is the Midland Odessa area. I'm about 45 miles to the east of the Midland Odessa area. We're right here in the middle of the Permian Basin.
Okay. What's the Permian Basin for those who might not know?
It's probably the largest oil and gas producing portion in the United States of America. The county that I primarily farm in produces more oil than any other county in the United States on a daily, monthly, annual basis.
Okay. That, before I even launch into more information about your farm, what does that do to your land prices? If you have that much oil and gas work around you, are you finding escalating prices, or have you over the years?
Yes. One thing that people have to understand about I don't personally do any irrigated acres. It's all rain fed or dry land, depending on how you want to call that. But 30 years ago, you know, $500-$600 an acre was pretty common. We don't have real high yields. We just have really, really big farms. So we can run really big equipment. It doesn't take a lot of inputs to produce a crop. Therefore, you know, we can afford to do what we do. We just have to be really big equipment and really efficient. Now, you know, something that's really, really, really poor, you know, not even have a water well on it, will go $3,000 to $5,000 an acre. Which for some of y'all, that's probably not very good, or doesn't sound terrible. For down here, that's really, really poor soil. Something that you would run maybe 10 cows to the section, that type of ground.
That does make sense in comparison when you're saying, you know, 5,000 to the acre for what you'd consider poor ground and probably just pasture ground, or would that also be cropland as
well?
Yes,
ma'am.
Okay.
Cropland is really variable. It depends on, you know, we have a lot of different soil types. I mean, typically we're a really sandy soil type, but a lot of it depends on whether you have water, what the slope is, things of that nature.
How long have you been farming? Are you a multi-generational farm there?
Yes, ma'am. I'm fourth generation.
And probably getting ready for another generation to join at some point, I would imagine.
Yes, ma'am. I have three children. The oldest is 14, youngest is 7. My oldest, he seems to be fairly interested in it.
Sounds like the right age for grain cart drivers.
yes, ma'am. Well, he for the last 2 years, I mean, I don't let him road between farms, but he very much has his tractor, and he works just like the rest of us do.
That's excellent. So in that area of Odessa Midland, what are you primarily raising? Like you said, most of it dry land, particularly for your farm, but what's in your crop rotation?
Cotton is our primary. Again, here where I live in Martin County, the one county to the east of where Midland is, we have more acres of dry land cotton in this county than anywhere else in the state. But y'all have to remember, like, the town of our county seat, which our county is roughly 40 by 40 miles, is like 2,500 people, and that's the biggest town there is in the whole county. There's a couple little outliers. We've got little country schools, but I would say there's probably less than 10,000 people inhabit our county, and most of us farm or ranch.
Oh, that's not surprising, Orion. If you start looking at North Dakota, particularly across the western part of the state and western South Dakota as well, many of us would see similarly sized counties, but also similar population. There's a lot of sparsity to our region as well. We just maybe, we get to be a little bit cooler than you do. Maybe we hide it better.
Yeah.
That makes
yeah.
sense. So it's not just a crop that you raise and kids. There's been a problem down there with wild hogs. Can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Yes, ma'am. I'm not terribly scientific about it, but a female sow at the age of about 6 to 9 months, which y'all probably have listeners that are hog producers, but we kind of say that a sow 6 to 9 months can have a litter every month, 3 weeks, and 3 days, and they are extremely prolific. They are a very hardy creature. Freezes don't bother them. Droughts apparently don't bother them a whole lot either. They're extremely destructive, especially in this part of the world where, you know, cultivated row crops are typically, you know, on a good year, the pastures stay really green. For the most part, we're not a real high stocking rate in this area. I mean, I'm not a cow person. I'm just on enough ag committees. I know a little bit of the math. But typically, our row crops are the only thing that are green during the peak of the summer heat. Like, we grow a fair bit of grain sorghum in rotation with our cotton and some winter wheat as well. But the milo, the grain sorghum, they can really, really be very damaging in that crop aspect. I mean, up to, you know, where they're kind of concentrated, they'll uproot or knock down 40 acres a night, potentially. I mean, that's, we've kind of measured it a time or two, and about that 40 acres a night is what they can take out.
Wow.
Now, holy cow.
Yeah. Now, I used to work down your way in San Angelo, beautiful, beautiful part of Texas down there. And I don't remember wild hogs being a problem when I was, I mean, this is back in the 90s. Is this something that's just kind of more recently come up, or has this always been a problem?
Yes. No, it has not always been a problem. I think we killed the first ones probably somewhere along about 2008, 2009, somewhere in that general vicinity. And the problems basically just escalated since then.
Hmm.
Okay. Where did they come from? Were they coming across from other states, other regions? Are these just commercial pigs that were left to their own devices? How did that start?
Okay, there's basically a twofold issue with that. It kind of tracks back to South Texas. You know, there's a lot of game ranches and hunting for sport down there, and they imported some Russian boars. Now, some of the other hogs, I mean, again, I'm not real up on the livestock, but you see what I would call a spot or a hemp color or a Duroc or, you know, different physical attributes that harken back right to an interbreeding between the wild hogs and then people that had domesticated hogs that got out, and, you know, over generations of reproduction, they do just go back to being feral, but they're good to eat for the most part, and you know, they're very, very prolific, but they typically have migrated north and west from, you know, South Louisiana, East Texas, and South Texas.
Wow, there's a lot of questions here for you, Arian. First of all, I can't wait to ask your favorite recipe if they can actually be eaten, because I was always told they were terrible eating. So I'm looking forward to that. But stick with us, because bottom of the hour news is here. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Orion Romine. He is farming in the Midland, Odessa, Texas area, and the wild hog problem has really impacted his farm. If you have questions, you can reach us on the JLA Insurance phone line, 701-293-9000. Welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus. And again, don't forget to give us a call if you have questions. 701-293-9000. That's the JLA Insurance phone line. And you can reach out to us to ask questions about weather, agriculture, but especially of our guest today. And he is Orin Romine. He is in the Odessa, Midland, Texas area. Farms down there, and they've got a problem with wild hogs. So, Orin, how did you decide to keep them from destroying the potential of 40 acres of crop every night? What was the next step for you?
Well, the way we were handling it, myself and brother-in-law, we were taking thermal scope rifles out on can-ams and basically patrolling turn rows and things of that nature from about 10 in the evening up until 2 to 4 in the morning. And, you know, then we'd get up a few hours later and either go bale hay or, you know, go about our normal daily getting on tractor sprayers, whatever. And that was really wearing very thin. But the thing was, is we were averaging probably anywhere from 40 to 120 a night that we were killing between the two of us.
Wow. I mean,
And really, again, you get into the Milo situation, and that's when it hits soft dough there in August. They come out of the woodwork like ants that you kick the top off of their bed. I mean, they really don't bother it too much until it hits that soft dough, but at that point, it they wear it out.
And Oren, do you need a permit to shoot those, and or is there a limit on how many you can shoot in a day or a week? How does that work?
Okay, the state of Texas, and I was going to mention that, if anybody else has these problems with wildlife, please, by all means, get with your local law enforcement agency here in Texas. It's the Texas Parks and Wildlife, or our game wardens. I know in a lot of places, Department of Natural Resources, that sort of thing. But in Texas, to hunt a feral hog, legally, you have to have landowner permission. Like, you don't even have to have a hunting license to hunt feral pigs in the state of Texas if you have express, which is essentially written, landowner permission, or their agent, which in my case we own a fair bit, but we also farm a lot for other landowners, and as their agent I am allowed to permit people to hunt. Now, in the state of Texas, there's no closed season. There's no bag limit. There's no daylight dark restrictions. I mean, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you can chase feral pigs in the state of Texas.
And what do you do after? I mean, I know Bridget was wondering this, and we've had a email question. Do you keep any of them for food, or are they not particularly edible?
If you can catch, the boars really aren't that good. Their back straps are pretty good. Even the big boars are. I mean, and you can get like a back strap that's probably so big around and about 18 inches to 2 foot long. I mean, they smoke out really well. The unbred sows, I don't know, somebody that knows more about that can probably explain that, but a unbred sow is really pretty good eating, and then the smaller boars, before they kind of reach puberty, you might say, are really pretty good. Like, I've smoked their hams, shoulders, ribs, backstrap, tenders, stuff like that. It's really pretty edible. I've actually captured them, the little ones, got the racing stripes on them. I've caught a bunch of them and fed them out to like 200 pounds and butchered the whole thing, got bacon off of them and everything. Mm. I mean, they're good if you'll take the time to feed one out.
So a question as well is, do you consider them dangerous? They're certainly destructive in the field, but in some instances I've been told that they will charge ranchers, et cetera, especially if there's a fairly sized herd of them moving together.
The boars aren't that aggressive. I mean, I've encountered a lot of them in the brush. You know, I do a lot of hunting otherwise as well. But the most dangerous part of them is a sow when she's got a bunch of little piglets, and they're extremely aggressive in that particular situation.
Okay. Another question. Are they in any way a part of the ecosystem down there? Or are these really, especially after your work with the Texas Game Wardens, they're a nuisance animal that needs to be eliminated?
Two things on that. There's not really any positive effect to them. They're really rough on fences. They root up crops. It doesn't take a very long Google search, and you can see where like a big boar or something is carrying off fawn, white-tailed deer. There's not really any positives to them. I mean, I suppose that they could be an emergency food source in a very dire situation, but it's not one that I would recommend, and we certainly don't need the volume of the population that we have today in order to support something like that. They're extremely destructive.
And prolific, because just from the sound of it, what you were saying, you know, how often those females can reproduce, it's like you've got to go hunt every day just to try to keep up to keep them depopulated, is my guess.
That is a very, very astute observation.
Okay. No, go ahead, Orion. Keep adding to that.
You know, you take all those factors into consideration, and I haven't ever been to the Dakotas personally, but I mean, most of the states I've ever been to have some sort of an outdoor hunting, whether it be deer or even fishing and things of that nature. They have a relatively decent game and fish kind of side job or side revenue stream. I mean, people pay to go and hunt in all these places. So I got to thinking about it, and I've got a really good friend that I trust very well. And that's what he does for a living, is he's an outdoor hunting and fishing guide. And we approached him and kind of got him in and visited with him and took a page out of the farming book. We do a lot of share crop 75-25 stuff on our farming, and we kind of applied the same concept to working with him and got a deal worked out where, you know, we gave him access to the land and we put in some infrastructure such as blinds and feeders, you know, for individuals who weren't really up to chasing them down in a high rack or in the back of a UTV, and let them have access to our thermal rifles and stuff. But started letting him sell hunts and take people, and we had like a roughly $40,000 profit there in 2021. I mean, we've been in a drought and the economy's been what it was. It's been a steady revenue stream, but that first year it was really profitable, and we really, really put a hurt on the numbers. And that, you know, basically brings us to probably why you called me, is, you know, we're, a lot of people have these things that they consider to be a nuisance, but, you know, it kind of goes back to the one man's trash is another man's treasure. I care less for the things. I mean, you just get sick of shooting them after a while. But there's always somebody that thinks that's like the greatest thing in the world, and they're willing to pay for that opportunity. So, you know, a little strategic marketing and finding the right people and sit down with a good lawyer, you know, your individual areas, ag laws and agritourism laws, you know, you really need to have somebody that knows what they're doing there to draft up your hold harmlesses and things like that, and good communication with your landlords and things of that nature. But it, you can turn something that's a problem into a positive revenue stream, and anything you can do like that in the ag community right now is an extremely positive thing.
Diversification matters so much, and you're exactly right about the one man's treasure to one man's trash, because there are times up here when deer get into livestock owners' hay supplies and other feedstuffs and just total it. So yes, there are times where someone might find that their treasure that they want to hunt. We just want them out of there and stop wrecking our hay. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah, we have a lot of sandhill cranes like that too. You said you followed me on X, I guess is its call. I still try to call it Twitter. I think I've posted some videos. I mean, like, we'll have cut milo fields, you know, half section. There'll be 5,000 to 10,000 birds out there dragging in weed seeds and everything else, picking the immature grain, you know, went through the combine. And they're about as bad, truthfully, because they bring in a lot of weed pressure that we wouldn't have otherwise had.
We understand that. Canadian geese have been a similar situation up here infecting fields, but we just didn't need that to be the case. A question that came from a listener as well: what do you need for a caliber for that type of hunt? Because, you know, again, we live quite a ways north of you, and we hear a lot of stories from so-and-so who went down there to hunt, and they want to make it sound like, you know, a 9mm won't penetrate a skull. So can you give us an idea about caliber?
Okay. You know, the story you mentioned, the 9mm, before we really got into using an outfitter and hunting them, we trapped a lot. Like, we probably captured anywhere from 20 to 50 a day through the wintertime, you know, especially around grain fields, wheat fields, cut milo fields, things of that nature. And I have done it myself. Like, I carry a 45 when we're going and getting big pigs out of traps, because a 9mm will not penetrate them in a forward on shot. I personally carry a 6mm arc in my pickup. That's what I kind of carry as my everyday gun for shooting coyotes and feral pigs and things of that nature. I'm sure most of y'all's ranchers up there do too. Y'all probably have quite a problem with coyotes eating, messing with livestock. Yep. Anything 6mm, which is 243 for folks that don't know, anything from that up is sufficient. A lot of it depends on what you want to do. Like if you want to drop him where he sits and how far you want to shoot. Like out here, it is not uncommon to get, which I'm sure up there on the plains in the North Plains, I've never been there, but I would assume it's very similar. If you have the ability to shoot 400 to 600, 800 yards, well, you could pretty easily be afforded the opportunity to take a shot like that. And the same thing down here, if depends on how close you want to get. I mean, we have people come through that want to hunt them with a bow. We have people come through that want to run them with dogs and pull them down and dispatch them with a knife. I mean, that's not really my thing, but there are people that would do it that way. I'm a big fan of me being over here on the hill and them being off over there and me shooting them from here to there.
I think I would be too. A little distance isn't a bad thing. So, yeah. One other question for you as well, and because they're wild and you don't have a commercial barn with pigs or anything like that in them, is there mention amongst other livestock producers that these hogs carry disease? I'm sure there's easy cross-contamination if this was, you know, a production barn and they were able to infect the swine there, but do you see any disease from them to either commercial livestock or just other wildlife?
We have not. I really feel like Mother Nature is really good on that, which is also kind of a net negative on our end, because natural selection amongst them, they've never been given a shot. I mean, they're living off of a mud puddle and whatever roots they can, you know, root out and eat for the most time. And they're an extremely hardy individual. I have never heard of any crossover from any sort of infections or diseases that would cross into anything else. I know I've got several friends locally that raise and breed show hogs, and they've never even mentioned that the feral ones would even want to try to come up to their barns or anything. So my answer would be no, but that's not a 1,000% for sure. I've just never heard of any of it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to visit with us and answer all of the questions. I really appreciate you doing that, Oren. Again, I know you've got busy things going on, but just thanks for answering the questions, because we hear stories, but it's nice to hear from someone who's actually in the thick of it and knows a lot about the hunting around that area. So thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you all for having me.
Thanks, Oren. Well, we're coming up on break now, so when we come back, we'll have another topic on weather. We'll talk about what this weekend looks like and the potential for a major storm as we head into next weekend. That and a few ag topics coming up right after the break. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus on this Friday, March 7th. Temperatures outside, depending where you're at, we're in the mid-30s here in the FM area. You go up into the Northern Valley, it's upper 20s to right around 30, and you go just southwest of the FM area out towards Lisbon, they're in the lower 40s. So a wide variety of temperatures. A lot of it's due to cloud cover. Areas that are seeing sunshine southwest of the FM area are quite a bit warmer. So we will see warmer weather, though, spreading our way for the weekend, with upper 40s tomorrow and upper 50s on Sunday. And looks like Monday, we're more than likely going to break a record with temperatures right around the 60-degree mark, believe it or not, on Monday, which is quite a bit ahead of schedule. Our average for 60-degree temperature, I believe, is that first week in April, maybe April 7th, April 10th, right around there. So we're well ahead of schedule for our first 60-degree temperature. We'll take it. No complaints.
Well, I think everybody will take it. Yes, absolutely. One thing that folks are complaining about a little bit, the price of eggs. And we've all been discussing it quite a bit. There's some tidbits of information here that we should be aware of. First of all, because we have euthanized so many chickens, and a lot of them were young layers, we now have the older hens who don't produce as well. So we have less eggs entering the market because of that. Also, older hens have thinner shells. When that happens, you now have a problem where eggs are breaking in transit, also decreasing the supply that people need. We know that there are now folks trying to smuggle eggs in from Mexico,
oh boy,
where eggs are cheaper. But because they are not inspected by USDA and APHIS, which is the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, they could be carrying some of the poultry diseases that are prevalent in Mexico. And if you are caught smuggling eggs in from Mexico, it is a $10,000 fine.
Whoa.
Additionally, yeah, there's a number of things. Folks are curious about vaccines because there is work being done by Medgene down in Brookings, South Dakota, on behalf of USDA to try to decide if a vaccine should be used for chickens or not. We can find a vaccine, but the long-term effect has to be determined because some of our export markets, when this all turns around, don't want a vaccine. So that's why there's been reluctancy to vaccinate poultry in order to avoid the bird flu. So this could affect long-term our markets. Meanwhile, and I know there's a joke in this somewhere, we are looking at importing eggs from the country of Turkey. We're getting our eggs from Turkey, our chicken eggs from Turkey. We'll see where that leads. Also, bird flu has prompted a number of other situations that became a little bit nerve-wracking. First of all, with so many of the DOGE cuts that happened at USDA, all of a sudden they realized, wait, we just wiped out a bunch of the people who've been working on bird flu, some of the scientists and so forth. Well, we got to bring some of those back. So that's been going on in the last week. Do we expect egg prices to go down? Dean, Addison, what's the next holiday on the horizon?
Easter, yeah. Probably not till after that.
So all those baked goods. I mean, mm-hmm. Raise your hand. Who remembers Grandma making homemade angel food cake and eating all the egg whites, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
Between that, dying eggs, et cetera, we likely are not going to see a downturn. Generally, there is always a spike in egg price around the holiday to begin with. What else could be driving that? Farmers are facing higher feed, fuel, and labor costs because of inflation. So that's been leading to the higher price that we've been seeing for eggs. Also, we have about 10 states that only have cage-free environments, meaning that you can't raise your chickens unless they are cage-free. Okay, in that case, when they are cage-free, they actually produce less eggs. So you have less supply. Often, those cage-free eggs have been dedicated to restaurants like McDonald's, but you have more consumers who want in on the cage-free egg, so now that has also really tightened up that supply. And for everybody who has been touting breakfast is the new dinner or supper, that's adding to our problem as well. We just have a much higher egg consumption. We see more restaurants opening up that are breakfast for all day. And because of that, the demand on eggs has been significant. So consumers are truly purchasing more. It is still on a per gram of protein basis an economical and affordable way to continue to consume protein. But it is rivaling the cost of beef these days on a per gram basis. So eggs are definitely a top of the mind discussion for many, many people. So we'll see what changes over the next few weeks. But just a few tips to keep in mind.
I want to see those $1.99 prices back again. That'd be nice.
Is that going to go along with the feedlot you're going to start that we talked about yesterday?
Yes. Once I win the Powerball, we'll take care of all that, Bridget. We'll take care of all that.
Best of luck. I heard the Powerball price is going up, so.
Yeah, probably. Well, for Bridget, myself, I want to thank you for joining us. Don't go anywhere. The Jay Thomas Show is coming up next.